Good afternoon. I think we'll start this seminar, and let me introduce myself. I'm Desmond Lochman. I'm a resident fellow at the Institute, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you to what should be an interesting discussion on should Greece default, what are the kind of lessons that Greece should be drawing from the Argentine experience. Let me just start by saying that when I thought about this seminar some 2 months ago, I had little doubt that it would be timely, you know, that my view has long been that the Eurozone problems are going to be with us, they're going to intensify, we're going to have them, you know, throughout 2011. But I didn't realize that the seminar would be quite as timely as it's turned out to be, you know, aided a little bit by events in Ireland, where the Financial Times, for instance, this morning is reporting about a stealth run on the Irish banks. But what you're seeing in the markets is you're seeing spreads now for not just Ireland, but for Greece, Portugal, and Spain at very much higher levels than they were at the depth of the crisis in early May before the trillion-dollar safety net was put in place. In addition, what makes this seminar timely is what the Greeks have done is Eurostat now reported 2 days ago that what we thought was a horrendous Greek deficit turns out to be even more so, that they're now reporting that the deficit, public deficit in 2009 is 15.3% of GDP rather than the 13.6% that one thought earlier, and what is even more scary is that the level of public debt at the end of 2009 wasn't the 115% of GDP that the IMF was assuming, but it was more like 127% of GDP. So the implication, of course, being the IMF thought in its program that by 2012, even if Greece fully complied with the IMF program, the public debt to GDP level would be 150. So we must now assume that it's at least 160, and there have been slippages. The Greeks have indicated that they're not meeting the budget deficit targets for 2010. They're owning up to the fact that the deficit's going to be 9.5% rather than the 7.8. So, you know, you've got to add a little bit here and there. The other thing that makes this timely is the Germans and French, you know, helped this along by agreeing at the last Eurozone summit that the idea of debt restructuring is no longer a taboo. They're talking in their wisdom about what's going to occur in 2013 when the EFSF gets renewed. They are now talking about the idea that you should have burden sharing with the private sector, which is a euphemism for, you know, some form of debt restructuring. And the Germans and the French, you know, seem to be a little bit surprised that the markets got spooked out. There's also markets are now seem to be connecting the dots and realizing that this crisis in the Eurozone's periphery isn't so much a crisis in the periphery, but is really a crisis that affects the European banking system, so that this is potentially an overall European banking crisis that would have global implications. Let me say a word about the reason that I chose to link this Greek problem to the events in Argentina in the late 90s, early 2000s. I thought that conceptually, Greece, together with Ireland, of course, finds itself in a very similar position to that Argentina found itself some years ago, namely that both Argentina and Greece and Ireland have got enormous external problems, they've got enormous public deficits, but they're stuck in very fixed exchange rate systems. In the case of Argentina, it was the convertibility plan, the peg to the dollar, that they thought was immutable, there was no way that that could break. In the case of Greece and Ireland, it's one step worse. It's that they've now got no currency of their own. And what this, of course, means is that it's very difficult to address problems in your domestic imbalances and your external imbalances if you're stuck without a currency to devalue, because there's no way you can incentivize exports as a means of offsetting the contractionary impact of the budget tightening. Another similarity between Greece and Argentina is that they're on a lifeline from the official sector abroad. In the case of Argentina, it was the IMF and the Treasury pumping in literally tens of billions of dollars for 2 years, as it proved in the end, to little avail. In the case of Greece, it's now money coming from the Europeans together with the IMF on the order of $140 billion. Let me just say a few words about Argentina, just to refresh people's memories, a couple of the stylized facts. I said that Argentina had very large imbalances, that at the peak it had a budget deficit of around 6% of GDP. Its public debt level was 65% of GDP. Contrast that with Greece, where we're starting with 15% of GDP and 127% of GDP. So there's a slight difference in the starting point. The same thing with the external imbalance. Argentina's external imbalance measured by its current account deficit was only something like 5 or 6% of GDP. Greece's is something like 14% of GDP. So that is difference. What we saw in Argentina was, in the end, despite the fact that it got a lot of IMF money, in the end, it ended really in tears, that they were forced both to restructure their debt and to exit the convertibility plan, despite a lot of money that they're getting abroad that was dealing with a liquidity problem rather than with a solvency problem. You know, there might be echoes here in Greece. When they left, the results were truly disastrous, that output plunged by something like 20%. Unemployment went up to 25%. When they made that 27-cent take-it-or-leave-it offer, they really got excluded from international capital markets for a decade. They haven't yet repaired their relations with the IMF. They somehow, though, managed to get themselves sitting on the G20, they're now managing to obviate the IMF in their Paris Club deals. I've asked our panelists to answer a load of questions. I've asked them to choose what to answer, but the two real questions that I think need to be addressed is, can Greece avoid the fate of Argentina in terms of avoiding a disorderly debt default? You know, that would be the one question. The bigger question, at least for me, is even if they do manage to restructure their debt, can they manage to stay within the euro? Can they manage to do the adjustment within the euro? What are the implications of their having to exit? I'll just conclude by saying that, you know, two arguments can be advanced. You know, the one saying that Greece looks like it's on its way to Argentina. That is, you know, what I've just mentioned, that all of the ratios that you look at in Greece, the relevant ratios, are twice as bad as they are in Argentina. So my priors would be, if Argentina couldn't do it with half the problem, why do we think that Greece will be able to do this within a fixed exchange rate with double the problem? Arguing on the other side is the notion that I'm sure Whitney de Beauvoir will emphasize, is that unlike Argentina, where practically the entirety of its external debt was covered by British or United States law, which gave creditors a lot of recourse, in Greece, it's a different story. 90% of their debt is covered by domestic law. And not being a lawyer, I leave it to Whitney to explain to us what the difference is, but it would seem to me that it's easier to restructure if you've got 90% covered by domestic law. I'm not going to take up time going through the individual's biography. They're all pretty well known. Just let me say, in the order in which they'll be speaking, Vince Reinhardt, who's a good colleague of mine at the AEI, was chief economist for the FOMC for many years, and his other claim to fame, some would say his greater claim to fame, is he's married to Carmen Reinhardt of Reinhardt and Rogoff fame, but he's been writing great papers with Carmen on the current global crisis. Next, we'll have Hal Scott, who's a well-known professor at Harvard, Nomura professor of the program of international financial systems, written widely on capital restrictions, international finance, and so on. Arturo Purzakansky would be our next speaker. Arturo is presently, has a position at American University as distinguished economist in residence. Before that, he was a highly distinguished economist on Wall Street, where he fought many of the similar battles in which I was involved in Latin America. So Arturo is eminently qualified, to give us the Argentine aspect of the story. And last is Whitney de Beauvoir, who's a renowned expert on sovereign debt restructurings, senior partner at Arnold and Porter, and previously was also he was also representing the United States on the World Bank's executive board. So with that brief introduction, I'll turn it over to Vince.
Thank you, Des. If you're wondering why it's so dark in here, you have to understand that Des is actually short for Dementor. For those who don't know Harry Potter, that's the grim, soul-sucking figure in the series. And the feature of
if you ever type me on word check, spell check, and you type in Desmond, it comes up wanting to correct you to despond.
Right. But the phrase attached to the Dementors, in just about all the books, it says, in the presence of the Dementor, things go dark and you feel you'll never be happy again. Second, let me just report in a very weird violation of comparative advantage. I'll be talking about sovereign debt this afternoon because Carmen's over in Cato talking about U.S. monetary policy. In terms of a roadmap, whoops, what, this is the pointer. I'm just going to make a few scattered observations about Argentina and the debt and economic problems, then talk about some unpleasant arithmetic when it comes to fiscal policy, and then finally make some comments about the underlying trade-offs. And first, as you can see, what I've plotted here is Argentinian real GDP, which pretty much tells you everything you need to know. First, that it can be very costly to maintain a misaligned peg. Real GDP in the second part of the 1990s contracted about 4%. The convertibility plan was all about imparting a discipline on politicians, but in a loose fiscal federation, politicians find ways to get around that discipline, and it becomes very costly to defend. Even more costly is default. The output decline in the midst of default was enormous, on the order of 15% spread over 2 years. But somewhat troubling for all the game theoretic models of the incentives for sovereign default, there was a significant recovery once that was pushed to the side. The recovery was sizable and also sustained. Although a fourth point from that same picture is something unique to policymakers and evident in Argentina, you get a health warning whenever you get Argentine national income and product accounts. The little label at the bottom says is an IMF warning sticker in the World Economic Outlook. private analysts are of the view that real GDP growth has been lower than the official reports. That is, the Argentines have been understating inflation, so the same nominal GDP produces a lot faster real GDP. That default episode in Argentina and the rapid adjustment was helped along by a significant relative price change. The Argentine peso depreciated about two-thirds when they went off the fixed exchange rate. That is not, as Des has already explained, a mechanism available to European countries, at least in the current treaty, needing to adjust. When you think about Greece, Ireland, Italy, Portugal, and Spain, these are economies that are already operating with significant resource slack. Unemployment rates from 8.75% all the way up to about 20%. That have very problematic fiscal prospects. This is only a snapshot as of 3 weeks ago with the IMF's fiscal monitors. The numbers actually are worse. And what's interesting, the fiscal monitors' numbers were already worse than what was published the week before in the World Economic Outlook. So tune in for next week. But the basic message is that we're dealing with a set of economies that have very large budget deficits and an inherited large stock of government debt. And so the compounding of problems associated with that are sizable. I'm actually not allowed out of the House in reporting only one data point. That's just not a long enough perspective. And what we've plotted here is the gross central government debt to GDP of Greece since 1919. The point to make is that Greece has pushed itself into a indebtedness leverage that is unprecedented in its history. There are reasons countries don't go into that region, and we're about to see what some of them are. Not only that, another feature of all these countries is that the leverage problem is shared with the private sector. The line in that chart gives gross external debt, public and private, of Greece since 1970, which is in excess of 135% of nominal GDP. A feature of financial crisis is private debts become public debts, and then public debts become a financing problem for the government. So when we talk about the need to delever and the need for fiscal adjustment, the slowing in economic activity, the slowing or outright decline in prices and wages will pose balance sheet problems not just for the government but also for the private sector. And, of course, it's not just a private public and private sector problem in those countries. It's also a banking problem for the rest of Europe. What that table does is give the cross-border bank claims from the BIS statistics as of the middle of 2010. And the thing to note is that many large European countries are heavily exposed to problematic lending to Greece, Ireland, Spain, and Portugal is in this chart. So it's unsustainable. And the message from Herb Stein, the late great AEI economist, which I believe Des quoted in a different context, is that if something is unsustainable, it stops. The problem, unfortunately, is Herb didn't explain how it stops. But luckily, we do have something that can tell us how it stops. It's the debt sustainability condition. All borrowers have to have a sustainable level of debt for the market to be willing to extend credit. And debt sustainability is a ratio with two things on the top and two things on the bottom. On the top is the current level of debt and the expected future creation of debt. That is, expected future budget surpluses or deficits. On the back, on the bottom is the real cost of that debt relative to the rate of growth of the economy. And if, in fact, the fiscal situation in some of these countries are unsustainable, something has to give in those four terms. There really are only four moving parts. The current stock of debt, let's take that one first. That is about the claims of investors, and they can be adjusted either through default or restructuring. There's a wonderful regularity in Kerman and Ken's book, This Time is Different, that is actually not spelled out in the text, but it is there in the data. And that is, there really were not many defaults in the British Empire or the Commonwealth. And political scientists have offered all sorts of explanations for why, including the role of language, Napoleonic code versus common law, distance from the equator, religion. They're all right-hand side terms in panel regressions. But the other regularity in the book is there were a whole lot of restructurings, not defaults. Why? For most of the history, default is something the strong declare on the weak when they've lost their patience. And a property of being in a club is you should have more patience with your members. So if what gives is the debt term in that debt sustainability condition, it might not be an outright default. But it could be it would be a restructuring that changes terms for investors, something club members are willing to live with. Now, what else is in the top? The expected future path of the budget. That is, how much debt are you creating in the future? Because basically that tells you the path through which you expect investors to roll over and over and over those holdings. And if at some point it's not sustainable, investors won't do that rollover. That all depends on the political willingness to make adjustments and the capacity to tax. So Des wants us to think back to 2001, 2002 in Argentina. I think we should also look back to Turkey, because there were two similar situations in important regards. They were countries that seemed to have unsustainable fiscal paths, that got unprecedented support from the official community, and benefited in a way that the Euro countries can't from a significant depreciation of their currency. One actually succeeded and one failed. Oh, and let me also say, both of them had incredibly inefficient fiscal systems. And there was a possibility that by being more efficient about tax collection, moving enough people into the official sector from the underground economy, you could generate revenue without the crushing restraint often thought to be associated with tax adjustment. Argentina failed. Turkey didn't. It was about the political willingness. The loose fiscal federation that is Argentina could not withstand the adjustments necessary to be more reassuring about the current and expected future path for budgets. Next. I'm not worried when he's setting his clock. It's if he goes like this. Did it stop? It can't be still going on, right?
I'm just getting ready for exceeding my time.
Okay. There's growth of real GDP, which is ground out by the private sector, but obviously importantly affected by government policies. And then lastly, there's the real borrowing cost. And of all those four moving parts, in some sense, the real borrowing cost is perhaps the easiest one that governments can push against. It's called financial repression. You have significant ownership interest in many European banks already. You have regulatory influence over those institutions. You can create a more receptive market for the debt you want to sell by financial repression of one form or another, lowering the effective borrowing costs. That, by the way, transforms a sovereign debt crisis also into a banking crisis. But right now it sounds pretty good. Raising prudential reserve requirements on your financial institutions, requiring your pension funds to have a longer maturity of riskless assets, that is, government securities, requiring insurance companies to have bigger buffers, or all mechanisms to create a bigger market for your securities and lower the effective borrowing cost. Now, about growth, I also wanted to add, or rather say, 1% twice. 1%. Okay. Why? Because there are two papers I'd want to point to. Carmen and I wrote a paper for the Jackson Hole Fed Conference in August called After the Fall. And we looked at economies before and after severe macroeconomic dislocations. And in the 15 severe financial crises of the 20th century, real GDP, that's that growth, that's the left-hand side, grows on average 1.5% slower in the decade after the crisis than it did before. So, what does that mean? It means that the countries facing severe fiscal problems also tended to have systemic banking problems, meaning there's already a force of restraint that makes the unpleasant arithmetic of debt sustainability even more unpleasant. To the right panel is a paper Carmen and Ken wrote for the May AER papers and proceedings. And what they established was that if you looked at the whole history where debt is available, 70 countries, 200 years, countries with debt-to-income ratios greater than 90% tend to grow 1 percentage point slower than other countries. So the countries we're talking about are reeling from systemic financial problems, veering into debt levels that mean they will grow, that they will, if historical regularities hold, grow slower, making the debt sustainability issue all that more difficult. In some sense, the issue about under-the-table restructuring, delay in the process of recognizing an unsustainable fiscal position is really all about delay in recognizing losses. The losses are there, we just don't want to admit them, which is a lot like the forbearance of the mortgage losses in large financial institutions around the world. And the problem with delay in recognizing losses is you actually impair the market for which you are practicing forbearance. The government securities market is supported by official actions and not conveying the signals that we normally expect that market to do. It also impairs the balance sheets of key intermediaries. To the extent that you use financial repression as a mechanism to delay the inevitable, you'll make your financial institutions weaker when the inevitable happens. It also requires other sectors to grow faster to compensate for the drag imparted first by a fiscal sector that's got to consolidate and a weakened financial sector. And if you think of the message of After the Fall, if you think of the message of Reinhardt and Rogoff, that's difficult to find those sources of growth. So I'm not actually going to opine when Greece restructures. I think it will more likely be restructuring than default for lots of reasons, including the ones I said. But it's not a question of if. It is a question of when, and it's a question of how. In some sense, it depends on the capacity for European officials to sweep this under the table. Their capacity is great, but the problem is even greater.
Vince, thank you very much. Before I turn to Hal, if I could just ask two questions of clarification. First, when you compared Turkey favorably with Argentina, am I right in thinking that Turkey had a floating exchange rate that made that a lot easier to do, that you could do that without the output loss? And the second question is, when you're talking about financial repression, the fact that 70% of Greece's debt is held abroad
does that mean we're talking about financial repression in Germany and France?
Okay. So two things. One is, what was the lead up to the crisis in Argentina and Turkey? They were different. Part was Argentina's fixed exchange rate and not having a mechanism. They did what? Yeah. What? It had an exchange, right. But it was not the hardened mechanism of the convertibility plan. It was something at the time Carmen would refer to as the fear of manifestation of a fear of floating. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But anyway, the point being that you could move off the one in a manner less dramatic than moving off the other.
Yeah, but I guess the point on the financial repression is that if you've got to have financial repression outside of Greece and you've got different interests between France and Germany in the sense that the French banks are very much more exposed than the German banks, you're going to have a slight problem of coordination and free riders and all the rest. It's a lot easier to do financial repression within your own borders than get other people to do it for you.
Right, but I would also point out that right now some elements of what you could refer to as financial repression sound prudent. Increasing prudential reserve requirements require larger liquidity buffers and the like. They have the consequence of encouraging the ownership of government debt in the same way that the ECB's collateral policies encourage the ownership of European debt. One reason so many banks own Greek debt is it's overvalued as collateral.
Vince, thank you very much. Professor Scott.
Thank you, Renee. I sort of feel we might be meeting on this subject with other names on a more regular basis. But let me start with, I think, a point both you and Vince emphasized, with which I am in total agreement, that there is a big similarity between Greece and Argentina, that they have large and sustainable debt burdens which required attention, either refinancing or bailouts. And as you've said, Renee, the Greek situation is getting worse. However, I think there are some important differences to note between these two situations. First of all, a large part of the Argentine debt, indeed one which enabled them to actually restructure, was held by local institutions, Argentine banks, even though it was denominated in foreign currency, the dollar. But Greek debt is, of course, in local currency, the euro, but it is held largely by foreign institutions. So that's a little bit of a difference. Greece is part of the European Union and subject to EU laws and regulation. Argentina has no such constraint. Greece can and has counted on support from Europe. Argentina did get support for the IMF, but I think it's a little bit less reliable, and I don't think Chavez and Cuba are going to do much for Argentina. Greek debt was issued under Greek law, as you pointed out, not U.S. or English law. I think this will become significant. Later I'll say something about this. Argentine debt was issued under U.S. or English law. Greece is part of a regional currency arrangement, the euro. Argentina had its own currency, whatever the fixedness or the convertibility feature is. The fact that you're in a regional arrangement is a completely different situation. There's some big differences. Greece is a much more responsible country than Argentina. Argentina is a serial defaulter. Greece is not. Argentina not only flouted its private creditors by making a take-or-leave-it offer for about 27 cents on the dollar when it had the capacity to pay much more, it was also flouted its public creditors, refusing to allow the IMF to audit its accounts in connection with its negotiation to repay the $7.5 billion debt to the Paris Club. Greece, on the other hand, is struggling to repay all of its creditors and has Eurostat delving deeply into its account in connection with the bailout it received. Argentina has refused to abide by World Bank ICSID arbitrations. It is not abiding by the Financial Action Task Force rules on money laundering and terrorism. It has basically co-opted the independence of its central bank. It has attacked the freedom of press. None of these things are present in Greece. My friend Arturo coined the phrase that Argentina was a rogue debtor. Maybe it's time to call them a rogue country. Okay, so I think there's some important differences here where we look at Greece, the cradle of democracy, and Argentina. Now, one option that I want to start with, which I don't think is an option, is I don't think Greece can abandon the euro. As long as Greece is in the eurozone, it cannot devalue its currency as part of an adjustment to its faltering economy, which, of course, Argentina could on its own. It could just end its relationship with the dollar. If Greece, and I wrote an article in 1998 called When the Euro Falls Apart, and kind of the point of the article is when it was going to fall apart, it wouldn't fall apart if a periphery country tried to withdraw from the arrangement for two basic reasons. First of all, Greece would find it extremely difficult to reestablish its own Greek currency, a new drachma. Greeks would not want to hold it and would move their accounts out of Greece into euros. They could try to seal off the borders, but they are part of the European Union, and even in border sealing, which we've seen in the past when countries want to redenominate or reestablish their currency, you know, we're now in an electronic world that didn't exist in those days. If Greece tried to do this, there would be immediate run on the banks as people transferred their accounts out of Greece into other countries. Greece has been euroized, whether it is part of the euro or not. Secondly, Greece cannot redenominate its debt from dollars to euro, which would be very important as an adjustment mechanism, as courts would not, in my view, enforce debt in the new currency. They would say that Greece had to repay in the old currency. You can contrast this when European countries went into the euro. There was a similar issue going from Deutschmarks to euro. But they created a whole legal structure that said that was valid, that was okay, okay? No such structure exists on exit, okay? So the consequence of this is that Greece, if it tried to redenominate its debt, would be in massive problems in the courts in Europe and elsewhere. Argentina didn't face those constraints. So I kind of rule out leaving the euro as not a practical alternative for Greece. So let me address some other options. What are they? They can get further bailouts funded by the European Financial Stability Facility. They can restructure their debt through this new SDRM mechanism that Merkel has proposed and that Eurozone has apparently accepted. It can get further bailouts. These aren't necessarily mutual exclusive, through ECB purchases of Greek bonds from the banks or acceptance of such bonds as at par as collateral for bank borrowings, and a lot of that's gone on. It could actually default in a real sense without restructuring. That's what Argentina did for a number of years, and that's what Russia did. Or it could try to restructure its debt, okay, not through this new SDRM mechanism, but through some kind of exchange offer, as many countries have in the past. So I want to talk a little bit about these options. Okay, so the first option, further support from the European Financial Stability Facility. Total funding, people argue about how much is real and how much isn't, but nominally it's about $950 billion when you put the Eurozone contributions, the Commission, the IMF money all together. But the question is, And it seems to me that, well, they've already, even before touching this, spent, $110 billion euro on Greece. Greece could come back for more. The problem here is that, you know, there are a lot of other people seeking money or may seek money from this facility as we sit here today. Ireland bailout is on the table, and there are other countries in the wings. So the real question about this facility to me is not whether it would work for Greece, but since Greece is only one of the parties that might seek to borrow from this facility, can they really afford all the demands that they're going to get in, And if they can, it's going to set up a very bizarre situation where you want to be the first to collect because the money's going to run out. And that seems to me to create some bad incentives. So I think the question here is, now they could appropriate more money, but there are political constraints here. Germans had a lot of problems just appropriating what they have, and I think another round of further appropriations to this facility would prove extremely difficult in Europe. So the second option is the use of this new European sovereign default mechanism, which was agreed in principle in October. Now, this is a little bit deja vu. In 2002, we had active consideration of a very similar proposal on an international level from the International Monetary Fund called the Sovereign Debt Restructuring Mechanism, which our government actually opposed quite vehemently, saying it wasn't ready for prime time. We don't need an international order to deal with debt. There are a lot of technical problems with this kind of thing. First of all, what triggers the mechanism? Second, what do you do with people who don't agree to the restructuring? You just cram down on them, or are they sort of not part of it, or what do you do? There's a concern that if you have this mechanism and operates in a regular fashion, it's going to send a signal to the market that all debt subject to this mechanism is going to be more easily restructured than if the mechanism didn't exist, and that, therefore, the price of debt will increase. Once the mechanism is in place and you think it's going to be triggered, people could withdraw money, therefore accelerating a crisis by creating added liquidity problems. A very important question is, how do you judge whether the plan that you come up with in this mechanism is a good or valid plan? Okay, now the IMS, well, we're going to do this analysis and we're going to see the capacity to pay. Well, you know, when you get right down to it, if you compare this to Chapter 11 in the United States, we have a benchmark, which is that the creditors don't like the plan, you go into liquidation, and that the value that has to be produced by the restructuring exceeds the liquidation value of the company. Well, this, you know, you don't have a liquidation value for countries, so that benchmark doesn't really exist. So how you determine the fairness of the plan, you know, as opposed to a creditor-run restructuring that's basically consensual, we now have some organization laying down what the terms are of the restructuring. And then there's the, you know, treatment of the problem as in the IMF proposal. People say, well, wait a second. We got the IMF, which is a major creditor with a preference, running a process by which it's going to impose losses on the private sector. You know, are they going to be objective about this? Well, you have the same problem in Europe. The Europeans are now maybe into lending to all these countries, and are they running the very process that affects them as well as everybody else? So I think there are a number of issues here that were not worked out for SDRM and I think will be hard to work out for the new proposal, although I will say it will be easier to work them out within a European context than an international context. Third, the European Central Bank continues to buy government bonds in the secondary market. So this has already led to, you know, high potential losses to the ECB. You know, people don't understand, of course, that central banks can go into negative capital. In some real sense, they don't need any capital. When they do lose money, the immediate effect is that their remittances to the government for their profits decreases. Of course, this was a problem for the Fed when it looked at, you know, its support of the banking system. Of course, they now say they made money, but there are potential losses in seigniorage remittances, okay, to the government countries as a result of ECB losses on their investments. Probably more serious is that these banks become, is whether this whole operation, and here I leave this to the economists, can be adequately sterilized. You know, can you go on lending at these levels and maybe in increased levels and sterilize the inflationary effects of the lending? There's also the fact that, is it right, and Trichet's been articulating this point, for the ECB basically to become the fiscal agent. Now, of course, Bernanke had the same problem in the crisis until TARP was appropriated. There are a lot of parallels here between the financial crisis for the banking sector and what's going on for the sovereigns. Fourth option, so a lot of difficulty with the ECB continuing. The fourth option is just default. I don't think this is a practical option. This is, of course, what Argentina did, because it would violate, or result in their isolation from European and international markets, which was the case with Argentina, and it would impose tremendous losses, on the ECB and the European banking system. So I think that, it's not a very attractive alternative. So let me come to the one where I have a minute for, which I think is the one that most people probably at this table would be advocating, which is a default with restructuring. So I don't think it would destroy the eurozone. You can have a default without abandoning the euro, but it conceivably could destabilize the EU by creating a run on the debt of other countries, possibly creating some kind of contagion. On the other hand, can Greece really keep up with the obligations that it has assumed under the first refinancing? As you've talked about, their deficit budget situation getting worse, and they are having trouble sort of meeting the terms of the bailout money, which, of course, runs out in 3 years. It's not forever. Some refinancing in terms of a restructuring could be provided by the EU, which I think is highly likely. But let me get to my last point, which I don't think is kind of understood very widely. The possibility of, or if there were to be a restructuring, all restructurings have to deal with holdout creditors. And the question is, how would the Greek situation differ from Argentina? Of the approximately $319 billion of Greek debt, 90% was under Greek law. Greek law does not permit amendments after the issue of the debt. So exit consent amendments, which are commonly employed kind of to poison the pill in a normal restructuring, cannot be done under Greek law. Greek bonds do not contain collective action clauses, which were, put forward as the alternative of SDRM. They don't exist in Greek debt. Holdouts may generally have more leverage because they can get a judgment in the EU and enforce it by attachment in the EU in Greece. So what assets would they attach? Well, Argentina, the holdout creditors have found it very difficult to find assets. Greece has a lot of state-owned enterprises, which was not the case with Argentina, multiple and substantial, whose assets could be attached. Furthermore, under Greek law, there's the possibility of attaching assets in Greece, because Greece reformed its law about enforcing judgments against a sovereign. Whitney, I think you'll probably talk more about this, in response to a lot of problems it had with the European Court on Human Rights that gave judgments criticizing Greece for not allowing the enforcement of judgments against Greece. They reformed their system to the point, that in my judgment, or at least the judgment of Greek lawyers whom I have talked, said that even, Greek assets like municipal receipts could conceivably be subject to attachment. So I guess here's the point. In any restructuring, you need to deal with the holdouts. The holdouts will have more leverage in a Greece situation because there's more to attach. That will mean that the Greeks have to give better terms, which may be a good thing, but it will bid up the cost of restructuring for Greece. And I think that has to be factored in maybe to our understanding of why Greece is not so willing to restructure right away. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hal. Just before I turn to Arturo, I've just got one question for you, and then I want one observation that perhaps Arturo can address. The first is, my question is that if 90% of Greece's debt is covered by Greek law, what is stopping the Greeks from changing the law to make it more amenable for them to restructure. You know, that I can see that you can attach and all the rest, but if you change the law, I just don't know.
It's a great question. The law that we're talking about is largely embedded in the Greek Constitution. So you might say, who cares? It's just the Constitution. You amend that. But as a political process in Greece, that would be more difficult. More importantly, a lot of these changes were kind of imposed by Europe. Okay, so if Greece were to make the kind of legal changes that you're talking about, it could affect their status within the European Union, okay, not just in the Eurozone.
The question that I had for Arturo that really just comes from Hal's presentation is that if we say that debt restructuring is really the solution, we'd really have to look at the composition of the budget deficit of the countries in question, that relatively little of the budget deficit of the countries in question is interest payments. So that, for instance, if we look at Ireland's situation right now, Ireland has a budget deficit of 12% of GDP, you know, excluding the one-off 20% of GDP that they did for the bank recapitalization. Of the 12 percentage points of GDP, only something like 3 percentage points are debt interest payments, so that even if you did restructure the debt by 50%, Ireland would still be left with the problem of having a very big budget deficit that it would have to reduce in a fixed exchange rate system. But I don't know whether Arturo wants to get into that issue, you know, that it kind of like doesn't get around the problem that, you know, if you don't exit the euro and you try to do that kind of budget adjustment, you've already got many years of really miserable economic outlook ahead of you.
Well, thank you, Desmond, for the invitation to come here and for having assembled such a wonderful panel. I should preface my words by saying that for nearly 30 years, I worked on Wall Street as an analyst, and my job was to spot investment opportunities abroad and also, of course, to predict defaults, in particular sovereign defaults, namely to spot disinvestment opportunities as well. And so I come to you here with humility, because obviously I missed a few. So let me reflect on what that means for Greece defaulting. So first of all, debt ratios and deficit ratios don't predict defaults. Obviously, if you owe a lot of money and you owe it in a foreign currency that you cannot print, a lot of it falls due in the next few weeks, and you've lost the confidence of your investors and so on, your chances are pretty good of having to default. But that's not Greece's situation. If you could just plug in some debt numbers and so on, whether pulled from the history books or otherwise, you know, I would have been replaced by a calculator. It's not so simple. It's not at all so simple. Obviously, how much you owe, whether it's for your own credit score or for a sovereign's credit score, matters when it owes and so on. And so, but it's not everything. The country that has the biggest public debt is Japan. And Japan can borrow near zero interest rates. So I guess there isn't a correlation there. The countries that have bigger budget deficits this year than Greece are the U.S., the U.K., Japan, and so on. Nobody seems to be worried about us defaulting. So you can't just go by the numbers. It's much more complicated than that, first of all. Secondly, as mentioned a little bit by Hal, it's very important if you have a sugar daddy or you don't. In the case of Greece, they have the ECB that's not only funding the Greek government, but is also funding the Greek banks and the Irish banks and so on by lending them money very cheaply. There's the Eurozone countries that are lending to Greece and are prepared to lend to Ireland and to others. There is the IMF that is put money on the table and is willing to put a lot more if asked. Even the UK has volunteered to lend to Ireland for obvious self-interest reasons. So no comparison with your typical country at the edge of default. No comparison at all. Another factor is of course, the issue of confidence and psychology, market psychology. The extent to which you can go through a difficult patch in your public finances depends on the demand for bonds. If there is demand for bonds, you know, if people believe that California isn't going bankrupt, they'll buy California bonds, even though if they were to look at the numbers, they wouldn't. Right now, there is no demand for Greek bonds or Irish bonds, but there could be next year. You never know. You know, if there's the mood in the markets changes, if the Greece continues to make impressive improvement on a variety of fronts in Ireland and so on, you know, that demand for bonds could come back. So it's not just a question of the supply of bonds, but of the demand of bonds. You have to predict how both will behave, and therein the great difficulty. Also, you know, analysts and markets and the numbers and even the IMF and so on, they can all be wrong. I'm not the only one who missed things. How many people were calling the end of Latvia and some of the other Baltic countries, saying that Latvia and Estonia and Lithuania would end up devaluing, would end up defaulting, you know, the end of the... In the end, they decided to tough it out and go through a 1930s-type depression. GDP in Latvia has fallen consecutively by over 25 percentage points. The Great Depression is before you. The unemployment rate rose from low single digits to over 20%. They decided to grin and bear it. What if the Greeks and the Irish were to do the same? Who said that they cannot? There's a lot of issues here of political will and support and leadership and good luck and, you know, dynamics and psychology and so on that could work in their direction. Remember Iceland? You're right not to think about it because Iceland is doing well. They survived. They never defaulted. There are some problems with iSafe, but in other words, in general, Iceland survived. Of course, they had exchange rate flexibility, which Greece doesn't have, and Argentina self-imposed didn't have either. But they also went through a very tough patch and decided to go through it. So the mission in front of the Greek people is not impossible. It's been done many times before. In fact, the fiscal adjustment, mostly on the spending side in the short term and on the revenue side in the medium term, because revenues are going to not perform well in the middle of a recession, that's for sure. So you got to work on the spending side. The fiscal adjustment that Greece is committed to is not unprecedented. It's about 7 percentage points of GDP or so on. And according to a recent IMF study, more than 40 countries have done precisely that kind of fiscal adjustment in the past 30 years, developed countries and developing countries. It's not off the charts. It's not impossible that they won't do. And in fact, as you know, they have been doing taking a lot of tough measures, and they have a long way to go because, as Hal mentioned, for instance, they haven't even begun to privatize. They haven't even begun to take many measures that they could. So the fiscal challenge is not unprecedented. The other thing is that imposing losses on creditors won't solve the problem. As you mentioned, the Greek debt, the Greek government debt, has a very long maturity, on average 8 years. Second longest among developed countries. The U.S. has 5 years average maturity, to give you an idea. So they can wait it out. Also, in terms of the cost of the debt, sure, if they were to sell a 10-year bond, they would have to pay double-digit interest rates, but they don't have to. The average interest rate on the Greek debt is 4.5%, because they borrowed a lot in the good times, and they locked it in. It's all mostly fixed-rate debt. And they're borrowing in the short-term market, where since nobody expects Greece to default in the next few months because it's so heavily supported by the EU and the IMF and so on, they're not paying double-digit interest rates. They're paying 5, 6%, something like that. So they're not materially damaging their fiscal sustainability. They're not running with a meter that goes very fast. So they can wait this out. That's a very important point. In other words, like you said, their problem is that the so-called primary, namely non-interest payments fiscal deficit, is large. The imbalance between spending other than on debt service and revenues, and that's where they have to work on, and that's what they're working on. It's not a country that has hugely expensive near-term maturing debt that could stand to benefit from debt relief. So I don't think if you do the calculus, even though, as I say, you have to take all the numbers with a grain of salt, that it's in their best interest to restructure right now. Now, a couple of final points. One is on this European version of the SDRM. That really worries me a lot. When Ann Kruger in November of 2001 brought up the issue of the SDRM, and therefore, you know, and of course she said, of course, this doesn't apply to any country now, as Merkel is saying, no, this doesn't apply to any contracts now. But the moment she began to beat that drum that there might be some fast track to default and restructuring, some kind of painless, you know, machine through which you could go and avoid all the pain and suffering of a disorderly default, the green light was sent to Argentina. I mean, no question about it. They applauded in Buenos Aires. They said, like, see, they agree with us. So I began to get very worried after that, because the signal to Argentina was, go ahead, hang tough. Don't just give them a haircut, scalp them. And that's what they proceeded to do. So I think the message here to Greece or Ireland and so on, to the analysts and the pundits, is a very potentially damaging one. Just the sheer fact that you cry fire before there is necessarily all that much smoke, I think is really dangerous. I think this is a very bad idea. As you mentioned, Hal, it's impractical anyway, but it just sets a bad tone, and it discourages the reformers and the ones who want to do good and the ones who want to pay the bills that are owed, and it encourages thoughts that, you know, there is some, as I say, fast track to default and resuscitation into financial markets. Finally, on the issue of can you avoid a disorderly default? Of course you can avoid a disorderly default. It's been done many times before. What you need to do if you want to avoid a disorderly default is don't do anything that Argentina did. Do the opposite. So, for instance, countries like Uruguay, Dominican Republic, and Jamaica have all gone through very orderly debt restructurings. For the most part, no principal forgiveness was demanded of creditors. It was mostly a question of stretching out the maturities or lowering the interest on the debt. I think a similar case might be Jamaica, where the government decided that it wasn't going to go on paying double-digit interest rates to the banks in Jamaica who held the government bonds. So it called them into a room, basically, and said, gentlemen and ladies, we ain't paying those egregious interest rates. We'll pay you half. So that was a restructuring. You never heard about it? It's because it was handled very well. Was it a default? It was a default, of course. The rating agencies counted it as a default. It's a breaking of contracts. But that's one example, never mind, as I say, what other countries like Uruguay or the Dominican Republic did. Yes, you can do a default with a lot of Vaseline, and you don't have a problem. So it is possible. There are many ways to do a restructuring. We've seen it in this country, how restructurings were done with the auto industry and so on. There are many ways to do it. There are many ways to do it. But as I say, I think the probability that the Greek authorities will want to do it or will be forced to do it is very low, although the probability that it will happen is higher than it was a month ago, thanks to Chancellor Merkel.
Thanks, Arturo. I guess you're differing from the market's assessment. You know, the market's having interest rate spreads at around about 10%. Apparently, the market's assigning a probability in excess of 50% that you get a default within 5 years, despite the support that you've got. But if I understand you, your advice to the Greeks would be, you know, just go Latvia's route, you know, just tighten your belt, have the depression, and honor the debt.
Yes, but I don't think they will need to have the kind of Baltic-style depression. I think that nowhere near a GDP collapse of 25%. So I don't think it's as tough a row to hoe as in the case of the Baltics.
Great. Thank you. Whitney.
Thank you, Desmond. Well, I'm a lawyer by training, so I've learned a lot of economics on the job, and I had a 3-year stint as a policymaker. I'm going to focus on things that lawyers usually do, which is they read documents and they try and understand them. And in that connection, I'm going to talk about the EFSF, these ideas about sovereign debt resolution mechanisms, and then the question that's been referred to about the terms and conditions of the Greek bonds, a very high percentage of which are governed by Greek law. So let's start with the EFSF. You know, in May, European officials announced with great fanfare that they had this trillion-dollar firewall for the eurozone. There were three components. There were 60 billion euros from the EU itself, 440 billion euros from this new EFSF, and 250 billion euros equivalent from the IMF. You know, I think at the time $1 trillion seemed like a reasonable amount of firepower, and it was actually much larger than many people anticipated, largely due to this EFSF. But how strong is the ESFF component of this firewall? Let's take a look and see how it's supposed to work. When I sat at the board at the World Bank as the financial crisis unfolded, I got quite a few lectures from European colleagues about the maladies inflicted on the global financial system by special purpose vehicles, low tax jurisdictions, and rating agency. So what is the EFSF? It's an SPV formed in Luxembourg, and the European leaders were praying for it to garner a AAA rating, which in late September, in fact, it did. So how did they do that? You have to look at the structure of the EFSF. It is designed to make loans of up to 440 billion euros to members of the European monetary system that are unable to fund themselves in the market. What is the first source of repayment? The first source of repayment is the borrowing country itself. The second source of repayment will be cash reserves, which are funded by the borrowers themselves. In other words, the countries that are receiving the assistance. There's also a nominal amount of capital for this structure. It reaches the princely sum of 31,000 euros and an authorized share capital of 30 million euros. That's right. You heard me correctly. That's million, not billion. But, you know, what were you realistically expecting? When we're talking about an SPV, the whole idea is to have low capital. Each borrowing from this facility enjoys a 120% guarantee of the other EFSF member countries, distributed on a pro rata basis. The guarantee, however, is not joint and several. Each guarantor is only responsible for its pro rata share of the guarantee. Of course, when a country borrows from the EFSF, it drops out as a guarantor for future EFSF borrowings. There's also an opt-out provision. Greece, for example, will not be a guarantor of any obligation that Ireland might incur. If Ireland borrows from the EFSF, it will not be a guarantor if Portugal subsequently borrows, and so on. In fact, among the EMS member states today, only five retain a AAA rating. Germany, France, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Austria, representing 56.25% of the so-called contribution key, as it's called under the framework agreement. The AAA rating of the EFSF is built on two key components. The AAA ratings of the EMS member states, which have this rating, and also cash reserves. Together, these two components are to cover 100% of the borrower's obligations. How do the cash reserves work? First, there is a withholding from any borrowing of 50 basis points. It's kind of like a facility fee. Second, there is a withholding of the net present value of the spread over funding costs of the loan, which is estimated to be about 300 basis points is the spread. And that's for the net present value over the life of the loan. So that's deducted. Third, they take the amount arising from these two withholdings, they add it to the amount of the loan that is covered by the guarantee of the AAA-rated guarantors, and then that sum is compared with the amount of the loan. If there's a negative delta, further deductions are made from the amount which is actually lent to the borrowing country, so that the net result is that either through a cash reserve or a guarantee from one of the remaining AAA guarantors, you have 100% coverage of the borrowing. The question then is the following. If the difference between the amount of the borrowing and the amount of the borrowing covered by AAA guarantees is to be deducted at the time of disbursement, what is the true firepower of the EFSF? The answer would seem to be 247.5 billion euros, or only a little bit more than half of the headline number. The further question is, how much IMF money will complement EU and EFSF funding? If the announced IMF component of 250 billion euros equivalent was premised on a ratio of 1 euro of IMF support for every 2 euros of European support, is the IMF support really only 140 billion euros? Or has the IMF leadership, in fact, taken the view that each euro of European support should be matched by 1 euro of IMF support? If so, will the IMF membership go along with such a ratio? Let us not forget that a shot was fired across the bow of that ship in Section 1501 of the Dodd-Frank legislation signed into law on July 21 of this year. That provision purports to limit U.S. support for IMF operations unlikely to be repaid, although many believe that that is a toothless provision. So there's some real questions there about, as someone said, whether there might be a perverse incentive to go for this money early or not, and, in fact, how big is this firewall. Let's talk a little bit about the recent public ruminations about the need for a sovereign debt resolution mechanism, which emanated notably from Germany and was pushed at the recent EU summit in Deauville, with, some would argue, I think, a rather predictable reaction in the markets. No one really knows what such a mechanism would look like, but an influential Brussels-based think tank close to both the Commission and the European Council recently published some ideas. They involved the creation of a U.S.-style bankruptcy court and a bailout fund to provide emergency financial assistance to a member of the Eurozone that cannot service its debts. German thinking on this seems to be motivated by the principle that private creditors be involved in any future rescues. And that's, in fact, what came out of Deauville. They talked about a permanent and robust framework to ensure orderly crisis management in the future, providing the necessary arrangements for an adequate participation of private creditors to be included in the Lisbon Treaty. Of course, as has been mentioned this afternoon, this type of thinking has been seen before with the SDRM. It died due to its complexity, both technical and political, because the intended beneficiaries, frequent emerging market sovereign borrowers, and the market rose up against it. The alternative approach was the introduction of collective action clauses to facilitate exchange offers, a solution that was proposed for Europe earlier this week by Nouriel Roubini in a Financial Times opinion piece. Let's think a little bit about insolvency mechanisms for sovereigns. You have to serve multiple objectives. You have to enforce hard budget constraints on governments. You have to maintain essential public services while you're restructuring, and you have to restore the financial health of the government so that it can re-enter the market. The need for a collective framework for resolving debt claims is driven by conflicts, both conflicts among creditors and the debtor, and also conflicts among creditors. Key design considerations arise, such as the fundamental difference between a public and a private insolvency. And here, mention was made earlier this afternoon of Chapter 11 in the U.S. Bankruptcy Code. I would submit to you that in the case of Greece, Chapter 9 may be the more appropriate analogy. Chapter 9 is the chapter for municipal bankruptcies. Greece's debt today, as long as it stays within the euro, is more like a municipal bond than a true cross-border sovereign bond. It's more like Panamanian debt than it is like Nigerian or Brazilian debt. The public nature of services provided by governments is really the source of this fundamental difference. As a matter of public policy, public services essential for public health and safety, for example, have to be maintained. This creates a basic friction between protecting creditor rights and maintaining essential public services. Creditors have narrower remedies available for dealing with defaulting sovereigns. Look at Argentina's creditors. They have many judgments, but almost no recoveries. This leads to the possibility of greater moral hazard or even strategic defaults. But when a private corporation goes bankrupt, all assets of the corporation are potentially subject to attachment. Not so with sovereigns. Usually when I talk at these forums, I like to say that the balance of power between creditors and sovereigns changed in 1907 at the Hague Convention when they decided that it was no longer good form to send the gunboats down to collect the debts. But, you know, this question of attachment is very important. I mean, look at what the U.S. government just told the Second Circuit Court of Appeals earlier this month. Foreign central bank deposits at the New York Fed are immune from attachment. Now, that's all in our own self-interest. You know, that's because we want New York to remain a major financial center. And London has the same view. Interestingly, Frankfurt, where the European Central Bank is located, does not have this view. In fact, I can get an attachment tomorrow on an account at the European Central Bank or at the Deutsche Bundesbank or at Deutsche Bank of any central bank deposit at those institutions merely by writing a letter to the bank. And believe it or not, without any intervention of a judge, they will honor that letter. And then it'll be up to the foreign central bank to go to court to get the attachment lifted. But in New York and London, we have a different view about that. That may be one reason why Frankfurt is not the great international financial center that many think it ought to be. The real question here is there's got to be all of these different adjustments, adjustments on the fiscal side, adjustments on the debt profile. And the question is, to what extent will creditor claims be limited? To what extent will sovereign spending be limited, and who decides? There are a couple of basic approaches you could think of, the judicial and the administrative, and also some hybrids. Judicial approaches put courts in the driver's seat. When is insolvency triggered? I think Hal referred to this. Which claims have priority? Which services will be maintained? Perhaps the use of a judge applying rules has some advantage in that it neutralizes some political pressures. But mandates for budgetary matters usually lie within executive and legislative branches. And when considered in the international context, the ability of a court to influence fiscal adjustment seems to be limited. Who is the sheriff who can enforce a decision to spend money on schools and not on pensions? Administrative approaches in the subnational context usually involve a higher level of government to intervene and take the political responsibility for many aspects of fiscal management. On the international plane, however, the higher level of government does not exist, although it may be in the Greek situation that various EU institutions would like to create such a higher level. As I mentioned, we have Chapter 9 in our bankruptcy code, and it has a mechanism by which a debt restructuring plan acceptable to a majority of creditors of a municipality can become binding on a dissenting minority. Essentially, this brings us back to the collective action mechanism. Of course, there can be a vote. It could be yes or no. But work still has to be done on defining the trigger, on the fiscal adjustment, and on the question of the negotiations among debtors and creditors and among creditors. In a case like Greece, fiscal adjustment necessarily differs qualitatively from national fiscal adjustment, as I said, in Mexico or Nigeria. Greece cannot use seigniorage finance, that is, unless it abandons the euro. And there is no adjustment through devaluation unless, once again, Greece abandons the euro. But the proposals for fiscal adjustment really need to be seen to emanate from the sovereign. Even if there are strong suggestions from the Commission or the ECB or the IMF, creditors could say yes, they could say no, but really it's the sovereign who needs to make the proposals. And the notion that a judge, even an international judge, can make these fiscal adjustment decisions for countries seems unrealistic. Let me talk for a minute about this governing law question. More than 90% of Greek debt is governed by Greek law. Of course, that means that Greeks can change Greek law. And at present, there is no provision in the bonds governed by Greek law, or in Greek law itself, for that matter, for amending the terms and conditions. But that could be done. One could imagine an attempt to legislate a collective action clause, a supermajority voting procedure for accepting changes in the terms and conditions. So then you have to ask, what are the sources of law that might discipline such a change in Greek law? The answer here gets pretty vague. The Greek lawyers will tell you a lot about various constitutional doctrines and various references in the Greek constitution to doctrines that relate back to public international law. You get a lot of palaver about the European Convention on Human Rights and enforcement of that through the European Court of Human Rights. Specifically, they refer you to Article 1 of Protocol 1 of that convention, which talks about the entitlement of every natural or legal person to the peaceful enjoyment of his possessions. No one can be deprived of his possessions except in the public interest and subject to the conditions provided for by law and the general principles of international law. One of those principles of international law, however, is the doctrine of necessity, which is much invoked by Argentina of late in the exit arbitration cases initiated by investors in Argentina. In fact, there's even one case involving Argentine bondholders, which is pending before an exit tribunal at the moment. But under the doctrine of necessity, we pretty quickly get back to the same fundamental question, which is, who decides how much adjustment is necessary, for how long, what is the kind of adjustment of bond terms, of structural adjustment, of fiscal adjustment, et cetera. So I don't think we have any definitive answers there either. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Whitney. I'd now like to throw it open to questions. If you've got a question, if you could just identify yourself and make the question, and perhaps I'll collect two or three, and then we'll answer. There should be microphones. Right, the microphone's coming.
Jacob Kierkegaard from the Peterson Institute. I guess I'd like to ask Hal and maybe also Whitney. One of the things that it's about these issues that Hal mentioned, how to deal with holdouts and the fact that the Greek government actually owns a lot of state-owned enterprises, et cetera, that you could go after. But one of the things that we actually saw in the latest revisions of the debt, the Greek debt, was actually that all these, what pushed up the total debt levels by about 10% of GDP was in fact the consolidation of all these things onto the balance sheet. So my question is, does that mean that these are now basically, from legal purposes, out of bounds, so to speak, so that they no longer can be, adjudicated to creditors in such a lawsuit?
You want to take a couple, sorry.
Let me take a couple, then we'll... Phil, if you've got a big voice.
Okay. Phil Suttle from the IIF. The panel is kind of comparing Argentina and Greece. I mean, the obvious comparison is Argentina, I think, at the max got something like 5% of GDP from the IMF. I mean, I forget the exact number, but the drawings were never very big. I mean, the figuring we've done suggests Greece already this year has had 50, possibly now 60, 70% of GDP from European lenders, particularly from the ECB. So in a sense, isn't this sort of whole discussion a little bit moot in that Greek debt is already being restructured? The public debt is essentially being shifted out of the private sector into public sector holders who presumably have a very long, potentially very long holding period, especially if they're real interester is holding the euro together. So, I mean, in a sense, isn't the answer sort of staring us in the face here that the restructuring has occurred, is occurring, and will persist as long as it sort of needs to meet European objectives?
Thanks. Robert?
Bob Samuelson, Newsweek. Could any of the panelists speculate on the possibility of chain reaction? That is to say, it seems to me that when you have one country or even two countries facing this problem, it's of a different nature than if you have four or five. And we had Greece in the spring. Now we have Ireland. There's Portugal. There's Spain. There's Italy. And the mechanisms in Europe for supporting this debt are in fact financed by countries, including Japan, including Germany and France, who are also heavily indebted. It's not as if these countries have clean balance sheets and they can afford to take on an awful lot of debt. So my question is not so much Argentina versus Greece, But what are the odds and the likelihood that this will morph into a much larger financial crisis involving large numbers of countries in Europe?
Let's just take that group and then we'll come to another. Whitney?
Thank you. On the question of access to Greek state assets, notwithstanding what Hal explained, some of the changes in Greek law, I have a very hard time believing that at the end of the day, a Greek sheriff is going to go grab some trains or some buildings or whatever to satisfy the claims of a judgment creditor against Greece. I just don't think that's in the political economy. There's a longstanding doctrine about the separate entity nature of state-owned companies and so forth. That may be used as an excuse. I don't know. But I think that they will find an excuse. And then you'll be left sort of with your European Court of Human Rights claim or whatever. And again, you're going to have the same problem of enforcement. I agree completely with what the thrust of Phil's question. If Greece started the year before they started adding on all the state-owned assets with 320 billion euros of state-owned debt, at the end of the current program, that will be, you know, 110 billion more of public money in there and 110 billion less of private money. So that, you know, if you were to say that in 2012 the support is not renewed and you have to restructure, the haircut that the private sector is going to have to take will be roughly double what it would have been had they acted at the beginning of the year. But, I mean, this process is underway. And if there's a default, there'll be a run on the Greek banking system. That'll have to be supported with public money that's already been recognized in the IMF program because there's a $10 billion window to start to support the Greek banks, et cetera, et cetera. So de facto, that's underway. And even if that doesn't happen, there's a factor that nobody here has mentioned today so far, and that is China. You may know that China jumped into a Spanish bond auction earlier this year at a critical moment, bought $1 billion, and basically buoyed the Spanish bond market. The other week, they were in the Portuguese market. It's in their self-interest to do this, to keep the euro propped up, because with their peg to the dollar, their terms of trade with Europe have been falling as the euro has devalued against the dollar this year. So it's in their self-interest to do that. So the only sources of public money are not necessarily Europe or the taxpayers behind the IMF. And finally, on the chain reaction, I think that the possibility of the chain reaction exists. I think there will be very strong pressure from lots of politicians to try and avoid that. The question will be whether they can come up with an even bigger firewall to prevent it. I think I explained about the firewall from May, but they're probably going to have to come up with a bigger one, unless they sort of, you know, enlist China or do other things.
But just before Hal, when it goes to Hal, just in terms of Phil's question, you know, I'm not quite sure that you're getting the public sector replacing the private sector in the sense that what is occurring is Greece is running a big deficit in 2010. It's going to run a big deficit in 2011. It's going to run a big deficit in 2012. To put it in other ways, is that even under the IMF program, what you're getting is you're getting the debt rising from 115% of GDP to 150% of GDP. So you partially what you're doing is you're preventing the private sector from becoming more and more exposed by having the public sector there. But it's quite a different thing from your taking out totally the private sector. Hal?
You know, I think the point is Whitney may be right, but we don't know. As things look right now, if I was sitting in Greece, their assets are more exposed to attachment than Argentina's were. And we got to work through all these issues that Whitney raised as to whether that will turn out to be true, but potentially they're much more exposed. Secondly, what that means is that in any consensual restructuring of the debt, we don't have collective action clauses in the Greek debt, any restructuring would have to be consensual, and this is going to give the creditors in those negotiations much more leverage than they had with Argentina. We're not talking about seizing trains and things like that. They're completely immune under the Greek Constitution from seizure. That's a red herring. In terms of state-owned enterprises, you don't have to go to Greece to seize that. What you do is you get control of the stock, okay? And you do that in Europe outside Greece. And then you go after the companies after you get the stock. So I don't know how Greece can ensure itself from, you know, protecting just the sheriff really doesn't determine that question. What the sheriff would be involved in is if you went into Greece to try to get Greek assets in Greece. And I think basically what you're looking at there in terms of any practical assets are municipal revenues. And there's some writing about whether municipal revenues in Greece would be open to attachment by creditors and satisfaction of judgments. There I, you know, tend to agree with Whitney that if there's a will, there's a way, then they'll probably protect them. But I think a major difference here is the state-owned enterprises. And Greece has not privatized the way Argentina did, and this exposes them to more leverage. On top of what, you know, the normal leverage is from trying to get trade flows and payment flows, which creditors have done with respect to Argentina.
Do you want to add to Bob's question about how contagion occurs and how this might be impacting?
But it also relates to Phil's observation. Yes, it is true there's an extraordinary amount of official support to Greece that is importantly carrying them, avoiding the funding risk event, and that is even made less likely because of the maturity of the Greek debt. The question is how scalable it is. What happens when you get past Greece and beyond? And I would say that the official support, in part, that was what I was referring to as financial repression. To the extent that official and quasi-financial official institutions purchase Greek debt for a price above that other market participants would, then the official sector is relying on some form of repression. That is, for instance, why Japan can have a 200% gross debt to GDP. It has a captive household saving that doesn't create the funding risks. The important question is how scalable are those resources? Europe has the key advantage, as Des said a little earlier, on the market to cram the debt into is bigger than a single nation. It's all of Europe. But once you start adding up the number of countries for which you will have to cram debt into the remaining countries, you get the unpleasant arithmetic that Whitney went through with regard to the, you know, who's left with the AAA. That's the issue.
But there's also... the issue that we shouldn't lose sight of is that there was an election on May 9th this year in Westphalia, you know, where the German taxpayers expressed a view, you know, that it wasn't a great idea to have Germany infinitely bailing out the periphery.
It was the German beer party.
Pardon?
As opposed to the
right.
Beer party.
So actually, one other point related is that the market dynamics associated with insufficient resources to fund all problems make investors want to pull the problem forward, and therefore it does become very important to be first in the queue. I think that worsens the adverse dynamics and makes spillovers more likely.
Yeah, just two clarifications. You're correct that in terms of the Greek government, at the margin, they're borrowing from official sources. So in that sense, the growth of the public debt is coming from official sources, yes. But I think Phil is correct that in the private sector, there is a substitution process happening also, because there are banks in Greece, in Ireland, and so on, who are funding themselves now with the ECB, whereas they didn't. So in that case, they're rolling over debt with the official sector. So yes, increasingly, the problem is within the official sector of Europe. And in terms of the contagion issues and so on, I think we have to remember, I mean, General Powell had it right. If you're going to intervene, do so with overwhelming force. And what we've seen in Europe is the disunited states of Europe, as with various other crises that have faced them, Yugoslavia, Georgia, you name them, they can hardly agree or agree on time or agree for very long on what to do. So the other day, for instance, you know, the market crapped out because some Austrian official said that, well, we're not signing the check, and so on and so forth. So there is a big problem, and I think that Europe could find itself in a very deep hole despite its best intentions, simply because it's such a disorganized political entity to make decisions in a hurry. At least here, you know, when we had to come up with TARP or when we had to come up with whatever, we did it, even through a presidential transition. It wasn't easy, I know, but we did it. And certain people have paid the consequence for it, but we did it. But in Europe, it's two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah, the other implication of Phil's question, too, relates to the inter-creditor relationships within the public sector. Assume in 2012, when the current Greek package runs out, that further assistance is needed. You have the IMF in there. You have Europe in there. The IMF says, you know, we are a senior creditor. We do not restructure. Will that be true for the European side of that equation? And then you have all of these Greek bonds, which are discounted at the ECB. What is that situation going to be? Suppose at that point the public sector says to the private sector, PSI, private sector involvement, you guys take a haircut. But there's a big public sector slice too. But to the extent that that money is on the balance sheet at the ECB, which is not a mark-to-market player, maybe they have the capacity to take a five-year stretch out and, you know, an implicit NPV reduction that the private sector would not have. So there are a lot of dynamics there. And if you talk about the IMF going in alongside the EFSF, you know, the holders of EFSF bonds are going to have this cash reserve and the AAA guarantees I talked about. The IMF has nothing.
This question back there.
Thank you. My name is Rose Allen, and all of you on the panel spoke about the concept of political will. Therefore, I will address my question to all of you as well. My question is, in your view, is there enough political will and public will to correct what has been happening in Greece? The future, so that there would be a more sustainable type solution that maybe everyone can learn from, especially seeing that Greece traditionally, it could be argued, has been a little bit of the spoiled child of the European Union. It certainly has been allowed to do a lot more than other member states. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, back then.
Hi, I'm Nikos Tsafos, and it's actually a great follow-on because I wanted to really talk about the politics as well. In the sense of, if you look at what's happening in Greece right now and being Greek, the change that you're seeing is actually quite extraordinary and very ambitious, and the things that are being talked about have never really been talked about in Greece, really, in recent memory. So I guess the question is, a lot of this stuff is happening purely in the context of, we're getting this money, be nice, we can get out of it. But if you start talking about default or restructuring, what is that political message? How can you go and ask the Greek people to make those sacrifices if you're at the same time saying that, oh, we're actually really going to default and suffer all the political consequences? Thank you.
Okay, are there any more?
Well,
On the last one, I'm not quite sure I got your question, but if there is a default in restructuring, presumably the burden on Greece would be diminished. So the sacrifices that were being asked from the Greeks people would be less. Instead of imposing the cost on the public sector and therefore goods and services that were being given to the Greek people, these costs would be imposed on the creditors, at least in part. So I see these as, any restructuring helps in some ways relieve the burden on the Greek people. But I would come back to the point that, Greek's attitude, I was struck by Arturo's hang tough, I don't think they want a default. I think they don't think that's respectable. And that they don't want to be an emerging market Argentina or Ecuador or who you name it. They're the cradle of democracy. They're in Europe, okay? And this is about Greece's image of itself, okay, as much as anything else in my mind. And so I think that is a deterrent to their wanting to say, oh, let's just, impose losses on the creditors and go home. And I admire Greece for that, actually.
Vince.
So I think the question is not can Greece repay their creditors. The question is will they want to repay their creditors? That is, will the Greek voters be willing to inflict punishment themselves in order to bring the fiscal position to a more sustainable path? That does raise the issue. The way I take the question is, will they want to see the burden shared with the official investors, rather the private investors? That is some element of restructuring at the same time that retirement ages are increasing, at the same time tax burdens are increasing. If you wanted to be optimistic, which is uncharacteristic sitting this close to Des, you'd say that the Greek fiscal system is extremely inefficient and that there are opportunities to raise the effective average tax rate with actually lower marginal tax rates for many payers. And in that sense, there is a capacity to move out to the production possibilities frontier in a way and deal with these problems. The question then is, does the political system withstand that? Not that there isn't that possible opportunity. Now, an observation with regard to the Greeks' willingness to do so. Obviously, they have benefited greatly from being in the euro, having the euro and being part of the union. The obvious benefit is they could borrow a lot at very low cost for a very long time. And I think no politician would want to give that up. The question is the next politician willing to use that as a platform to get into office? That's an open question. And with regard to that willingness to avoid default, it happens to be the case that for half the years of this century, Greece has been in default. The 20th century. Greece has been in default. They've been there. They've done that.
I'm not going to speculate on the politics, if for no other reason than I do enjoy vacationing in Greece, and I don't want to. right. But I think you just have to look at the objective facts, as Desmond pointed out. There was an election which just took place, and it seemed that there was political will to sustain the reforms. The question is, as you grind on into year three, year four, year five, and the ratios are not any better, et cetera, does that become sustainable? Will there come a populist politician who will say that the way out of this is to default? I think we have to be careful with the use of the term default. I think it was implicit in something that was said earlier today. A rating agency's default when you launch an exchange offer is a sovereign's liability management. And it's perfectly respectable, and sovereigns do this every single day. It's what the U.S. Treasury does every week is liability management. You have exchange offers. You have buybacks. You have ways of stretching out the maturity of your debt, reducing interest costs. Now, it's been pointed out that the maturity is already pretty long and the cost is actually still is pretty low. So that's more a question of timing and getting the right moment. It may be at some point that a Greek politician faced with, real populism on one side will say, okay, we're going to make an exchange offer. We're going to say we want 5 more years maturity on our bonds. There'll be an implicit NPV reduction of X. And then he goes to his people and says, look, we restructured the debt. On the other hand, as I think Desmond pointed out, you may not really be solving the problem because the debt service as a percentage of GDP is not very high at this point.
Well, I was just going to comment. Ted Truman from the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I was just going to comment on it seems to me, the last two questions, which you didn't entirely answer, it seems to me. Where I heard them is Greece has to reform, right? And that would be good for Greece in the long term. Get, as Vince said, get them to the production possibility curve in terms of their fiscal efficiency and things like that. Right? So for those who are pressing for immediate default or immediate move into a restructuring mode, right? The question is actually whether that increases or reduces the chances that Greece will be a healthier economic and financial place, and political too for that matter, in 10 years. I think to me that's a fairly complicated political question for the Greeks on the one hand and the Greek leadership, for their partners in Europe, who after all are tied together with them in many different directions. And my obvious bias is that pushing an early default probably lowers the probability of substantial economic and political reform. On the other hand, if you push it too far, the whole thing will unravel. So that, I think, is the sort of the delicate problem that the creditor community or the official/creditor community, who have quite different interests in this context than the private/creditor community. It's not clear. Some may rush things early sooner rather than later if you're worried that the longer you wait, the bigger the haircut you're going to have. There's one other slight issue which seems to be related, which I think was implicit in the remarks, is that my understanding is that even if you had a situation in which they stopped paying all debt now, the fiscal situation is such that they would still have a deficit. And in some sense, it doesn't. So you have you could argue, I don't know which way that cuts, right? But it does mean that it's an illustration of the fact that you have not even come start to solving the problem in the terms of the economic reforms that inevitably are going to be necessary. And I assume that the political leadership understand, or at least at one level of intellectual understanding, understands that point, right? That in some sense, in the very near term, stopping paying actually doesn't reduce the amount of hurt. Doesn't not reduce the number of years you're going to have to raise your retirement age in the very short run. At some point, it becomes a bit more difficult.
I just wanted to say that political will, that's precisely one of those very difficult things to quantify. Do we in this country have the political will to make the tough choices, about Social Security and Medicare and Fannie Mae and just many things? Who knows, right? The financial markets are clearly doubting that political will. That's what they're saying. But the financial markets have been wrong before many times. I mean, they thought subprime borrowers had lots of will to pay. And we found out the hard way. So precisely, we cannot be mechanistic because we never know what inherent strength there is inside of us or inside of a society to change for the better. And with regard to Ted's point, I think the experience is very mixed. There are countries who got substantial debt relief and went on to borrow again as soon as they got, you know, especially a lot of the HIPC countries, you know, they got their debt was forgiven. They said, great, we can start from scratch. And certainly in Argentina, you know, after stiffing the creditors, they went on to spend all the money that they would otherwise have paid the creditors for not very good ends. There are some cases, however, you know, the Greece of today is not the Greece of 50 years ago. The Italy of today is not the Italy of 50 years ago. I mean, many countries have made an important turning point in their history, and that's why they are perceived to be creditworthy. That's why they're perceived to have the political will. Time will tell.
Could I imagine that restructuring could be an important quid pro quo to encourage domestic reform and therefore represent a burden sharing between the citizens and the international investors? Yeah. And if you actually think of it, you usually shouldn't give up that chip too early, especially before the hard domestic reforms are done. So I think that's a sequence in which, even if you see hopefully you see progress on fiscal reform, that doesn't necessarily limit the probability of restructuring in the future. The political outcome may mean it's necessary. Another point is graduation's really tough when you look at the long time series Mexico has graduated. Spain and France were once serial defaulters. That once happened to be the 16th and 17th into the 18th centuries. So you can get out of it, but the extent of relapses, is also significant.
But I think that there was a part to Ted's question which suggested that the debt restructuring really doesn't get you that far. You know, you're still left with that basic problem of a very large budget deficit in a fixed exchange rate system. And to my knowledge, there aren't too many countries that have had a successful experience of making 10 percentage points of GDP fiscal adjustments in a fixed exchange rate system without having a depression. So, you know, that would really raise the question of why go through the ringer if the end result is that you're going to be forced out of this arrangement.
Thanks. Yeah, and I mean, I take the premise in Ted's question, but I think there's another side to it too, which is the political will of the other members of the community of which Greece is a part, and how long are they going to sustain this? And I think you can make the point that the incomplete European project, as it's called in Europe, is actually a big problem for the world today. I mean, look at the G20 in Korea. You know, if there were a true European project and Europe were more like the United States, you might not have Germany complaining about the ideas that were put on the table in Seoul. So that's another dimension of it.
Well, I guess I'm more optimistic about Europe. They responded pretty dramatically and quickly to this crisis. Maybe we could compare how long it took us to get TARP. They have a parliament, but they don't really have a parliament. We have a Congress that is a real Congress. Okay, so when you look at the political dynamics of response, okay, I'm not so sure that Europe doesn't kind of measure up there so far. Okay, I think it's actually striking. I mean, we don't like the sovereign debt restructuring mechanism. They agreed to it within like a month or something. They put this fund together extremely quickly. So all I see there is a tremendous ability to respond to the crisis, and I give them a lot of credit for it.
I think that's a great way to uncharacteristically end a discussion on an optimistic note. So I hope that you're right, but I'm sure that we'll have another two or three of these seminars the next 6 months to show otherwise. Thank you very much for coming.